Hi everyone, welcome to Grimshaw Spotlight, where we shine a light on the latest IR research at the LSC and beyond. I'm your host, Carol Aduco, and today I'm with one of my co-editors, Ricardo Gon, and we're interviewing Michael Cox. He co-founded LSC Ideas, the LSC Foreign Policy Think Tank, in 2008. He's lectured and contributed to institutions worldwide, including being chair of the United States Discussion Group at Chatham House and senior fellow at the Nobel Institute in Oslo. He's an expert in US foreign policy and LSC history, and he's published several books on these topics and more. We're going to be talking with him about the US and the upcoming elections and his latest publication on the war in Ukraine and the history of the LSC. First of all, I want to thank you for coming on, Professor Cox. It's lovely to have you on.
It's very nice to be here and supporting the Grimshaw in their 100th anniversary year.
Thank you. That's really kind of you. I'll hand it over to Ricardo right away to start asking our questions.
So today we're going to talk about the US foreign policy in general and the upcoming elections that in a troubled world seems to be a great issue at the moment. And we want to ask first to Professor Cox, in the Trump and Biden's roles in this US foreign policy, the first question is, was the Trump foreign policy effective in some way, or the positive economy was reflective of a previous decision and some previous foreign policies issues that reflected also previous politics? So was he effective in some way, or was he absolutely not?
Well, I think there's more than one question there. In terms of Trump's economic performance and America's economic role, I mean, the fundamental point to make is, frankly, the United States economy is so strong in so many ways that it is difficult to do it major damage. So if we look at the US in, you know, after 2008, after the financial crisis, I mean, it was really President Obama who took some pretty radical economic measures to bring America out of the recession, cheap money and many, many other things besides. He also saved two of the car industries. So in many ways, when Trump finally took over in 8 years later in 2016, the economy was already in a recovery mode. Now, that's making the argument for President Obama, not for Trump. Now, it is argued by the supporters of Trump, at least on the economic side, that he did two or three things which helped then boost the economy yet again. One, major tax breaks. Secondly, although environmentalists may not like this, he opened up a lot of coal mines and deregulated on the oil industry. And thirdly, he was very, very pro-business. And if you talk to a lot of businessmen, and I did at the time, I was always surprised, but I shouldn't have been surprised, to find out how many businessmen supported Trump. Whatever you may think of his politics or his ideas on immigration or on Muslims or on the NATO alliance or on Russia or on Putin, on the economy, you know, there was a kind of sense that he did a job that boosted the US economy. And so when he came to be to the second election in 2020, his vote went up by about 13 or 14 million. So it rose from about, what, mid-60s to about 75. And some of that was on all sorts of other questions. Immigration, America first, make America great again, American nationalism, American nativism, building a wall on the border down with Mexico. He appealed to that kind of gut nativism of many Americans, not all Americans. On the other hand, there was an economic record he could point to. So whether you like Trump or hate him, and whether you despise him or don't, I mean, the fact of the matter is that he did better in the second round, but he still lost the election to Joe Biden, which he then went on to deny. And that has been the fundamental problem. The real problem in the United States today, I think, frankly, is not economic. The fundamental problem in the United States today is political and ideological. And I think that's what one should really be talking about. The economy is strong. The US dollar is still the major currency in the world. US corporations are still dominant in the top, you know, if you look at the top 10 of all the AI and all of the, you know, all the advanced technology, the United States is well up there in many, many other areas. You know, I mean, others are trying to catch up, like China. Some do compete, like some of the Europeans. But the US and New York still dominates the international economic and financial order. If there is decline in the United States, it's not reflected in the economics. Where it is reflected, and this is the crisis of America today, that having all this economic and indeed military power, the politics of the United States at the moment is in deep disarray. Polarization, blue states, red states. Democrats don't talk to Republicans. Congress is in a mess. You can't get anything done. Trump is almost certainly going to stand as Republican candidate against Joe Biden, who is in a bit of trouble at the moment, as we know. And we just don't know how this election is going to work out in November. I know we're going to talk more about that in a moment. The only thing we can predict at the moment is that whoever wins, it's going to be A, a very nasty election, and B, if Trump loses again, which he could do, then there will be further disarray within the American political order. And that is the real crisis of the United States today.
Thank you. That's very insightful. And I think I want to talk a little bit more about what you just mentioned in terms of, as you said, obviously the U.S. economy is very strong, but the political element is there and it's, you know, coming to the surface with these elections that are coming up. I wonder what your thoughts are regarding if, for example, Trump were to win this election, consequences would this have for the U.S. as a international powerhouse?
It really depends on who you ask. You may have noticed the other day, the ex-Fox News journalist, a very popular journalist, it has to be said, Tucker Carlson, did what was described as an interview with Putin, which wasn't much of an interview. But nonetheless, it does demonstrate Tucker Carlson is quite close to the Trump people. And therefore, the first person who's probably going to be very, 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 very happy if Trump were to be elected, I mean, it's got to be Putin. I mean, it's quite clear that the Putin people were keen on Trump before, and they've not been keen on the Democrats because of the war in Ukraine and many other things. And they would certainly be very keen on Trump winning again. So, point one, I think the Russians would be happy. The one group of people who are going to be deeply unhappy, two groups of people can be deeply unhappy about a Trump election if it happens. Nobody can say for definite it's going to happen, so we've got to be careful. Too many people at the moment are talking as if Trump's already elected, and I think that's foolish, short term, and not wise. Don't predict anything in the future. But the two people who'd be most unhappy, I think, are going to be American Democrats with a big D and American progressives, American students, Americans from Generation Z. I think they'll be deeply unhappy. And we don't know how they would respond to a Trump victory, particularly if it came about in very problematic circumstances. And the second group of people are going to be very unhappy, of course, are going to be most of the Europeans, including the UK, who had 4 years of Trump and frankly don't want another 4 years of Trump.
Thank you very much. And also, considering this role of the US internationally, as we were speaking about China, about Russia, do you reckon that the U.S. is still a big wall for capitalism in the world? And what would change with Biden or Trump elected presidents with regards to capitalism towards China and Russia? What would be, in your opinion, the biggest changes?
Well, America was established as a capitalist enterprise. And somebody said There were two foundational props for the United States going back to the 16th and 17th century. One was God, and the other one was capitalism. And maybe a combination of God and capitalism is what's made America great, both in the past and, as Trump would put it, again. So capitalism is at the very heart of what America is. There's never been a very powerful socialist movement in the United States. Before the First World War, the Communist Party became fairly influential in the unions in the 1930s and 40s. But as a great German sociologist, Werner Sombart, once put it in a question, he said, why is there no socialism in the United States? So, you know, the United States is about capitalism, it's about the free enterprise system. It's very different to Europe, and indeed very different to the kinds of social democracy that we've seen in Britain over very many years, and different, actually, by the way, to the rest of the world. You know, America is free enterprise, and that's what America's about. So there's no question that no American president's going to go forward saying either, I don't believe in God, or I don't believe in capitalism. You know, so the question is what the varieties of capitalism are. I think that's the interesting question. I mean, I'd put Trump, if I can put it in economic terms, I'd see Trump as the kind of political economy of the robust free market variety, which is very deeply embedded in the United States. Individualism, deregulation, take away, don't tax people, tax is almost illegitimate, you know, that kind of thing. And I'd see Biden far more, and I use the term quite carefully here, but I think it's one that should be used. Biden himself would never use the term, but there's something very Keynesian about Biden. I mean, he doesn't see government as the enemy of the market, which I think Trump does. I think he sees the American federal system and government as a major enabler of the American economic success story. And in that regard, I think he also goes back, not just theoretically, to Keynes, who he doesn't talk about, of course, because people don't talk about Keynes these days in those terms. But I think he does go back to the 1930s and the New Deal. I think there's much about Joe Biden's economic philosophy, which is very New Deal. There's also something else about Biden which people haven't picked up on or not. You know, he comes from a very humble, not you know, poor family, but he comes from a pretty humble family. I think that's very much in his economic DNA as well. He talks to trade unions. You know, he actually stood on the picket line not very long ago in Michigan. I don't think that makes him a kind of working class hero, so to speak. But nonetheless, there is something about Biden which kind of means that he has to appeal to American trade unions. And he's very keen on building up the American trade union movement as part of the base of the Democrat. He wants really, he kind of sees the Democratic Party of, say, the Clinton era, he kind of sees that as being a bit trendy, you know, a bit new age. Mm-hmm. whereas I think he basically thinks the Democrats have got to get back to their historical roots in working people, whether rural or urban. And, you know, to some people, to many people, that does appeal. But I do think there's a very, they both believe in the market. The question is what they see as the balance between government and the market. I think for Trump, largely, it's the market, it's the market, it's the market. You know, it's very Hayekian, it's very much in the free market tradition of government is the enemy. And this is very deeply embedded in the Republican Party going back to Ronald Reagan, of course, government is the enemy. Whereas I think Biden goes back to a deeper, longer-term democratic tradition rooted in the New Deal and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So there is a difference there. I think it's an important one, too.
I think, yeah, that's incredibly interesting to think about, you know, how those two approaches are, as you were saying, going to be really impacting what the future of the economy in the world looks like as well, because as such an important player in the world economy, obviously the route that the US chooses to go down obviously will influence that very heavily. I do want to kind of take a turn right now and go back to what we mentioned earlier about the war in Ukraine, and I have a question regarding something that came out of LSE Ideas not too long ago in 2023, and that was a public policy review that talked about the future of the global order and how the war in Ukraine impacted that. You edited that piece and you also contributed to it with an article. And there were other contributors such as Robo Faulkner, Chris Alden, and even Nathalie Tocci, who we had on our podcast not too long ago. I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on what impact the war in Ukraine has had or is having on the international system, and how, as a longer conflict, it's kind of shaping what we think about in terms of security in Europe and beyond.
Yeah, good question. A big question. And of course, if we're looking at kind of major international conflicts at the moment, I think we have to locate Ukraine within a series of other conflicts, one which has just broken out yet again in the Middle East between Israel and Gaza ongoing, and that's going to have a big impact. And of course, there's the longer term geopolitical rivalry, which could one day become military, we don't know, between China and the United States, which are, after all, the two biggest economies in the world. So when I mention talk about the importance of Ukraine and the war there, Russia's war against Ukraine, it isn't just to privilege it in any way or to deny the significance of other important kind of fundamental conflicts, either in the Middle East or indeed between the United States and China. It is simply that is what I was writing about, and that is what I had just edited a book for LSE Press upon, which you were very kind to mention. There are a number of ways, I think, in which this has changed the world in its own right, without even mentioning China and the United States, or without mentioning what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. I think maybe in two or three ways. Firstly, I think it's simply changed the whole political strategic culture of Europe at a stroke. We've now got two more members of NATO in the shape of Finland and Sweden. Military spending in Europe is going up. Military spending globally is going up. And I think that all comes back, not entirely, but in large part because of the war in Ukraine. Secondly, it has had a major impact on costs around the world, transportation costs, the cost of food. You know, it certainly contributed to the cost of living crisis, which many people have been talking about, which in turn is going to determine quite a lot of the elections we're going to see in Europe and the United States and the UK over this year of 2024. It's contributed too to a kind of destabilization of the world as well, more generally, I think. And what I see in one of the kind of not surprising consequences of spin-offs of the war is how much it has certainly, I don't want to overgeneralize, but the degree to which it has divided what we might call in generic terms, collective terms, the global north from what rather imprecisely is referred to as the global south. Now, it isn't the case that all nation states in the global south have supported the war. They have not. And of course, public opinion in the global north is itself divided over this particular war, as we well know. But nonetheless, you could say as a generalization that the global south, or at least a large number of countries and public opinion in the global south, takes a less straightforward view on the war than in the global north itself. But the global north overall, with one or two exceptions, supporting Ukraine as far as they need to or want to, whereas in the global south, there's a greater degree of ambiguity about this one. I think that's been further exacerbated, that divide, by what we've seen been going on between Israel and Gaza, where again, you begin to see a rift opening up between perceptions. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize, but perceptions in what, let's call it the global north for the moment, and perceptions in the global south, with the global south far more clearly, unambiguously on the side of the Palestinians, unambiguously on the side of the Palestinians, not Hamas per se, on the side of the Palestinians, and the global north saying, well, we understand Israel's security needs and what it has to do, particularly that of the United States. And that in turn, as I think, is doing quite a lot of damage to America's global image at the moment. Whereas I would say that, whereas a lot of people would say, well, the United States came in and, you know, on a legitimate basis of supporting Ukraine against the aggression of Russia, you could say it even gained some kind of moral, you know, platform on that, although some would dispute that, I know. Mm. Nonetheless, on the question when we come to Israel and the Gaza, I mean, the United States, I think, is beginning to lose that, particularly in the global south and even in the global north, certainly among certain key groups of people, including large numbers of younger people who take a very different view of what's going on as maybe some older generation. But I think much of this does go back to the disturbance caused by that very unexpected war which broke out in February of 2022. I say unexpected because the only group of people who did expect it, by the way, was the American Central Intelligence Agency, which for the very first time in a long time got something very right. Whereas a lot of other people, I think, either thought Putin wouldn't do it, but he went ahead and did it. And that, again, I think, added to the shock. Mm. That added to the shock of what... And the shock continues. And now the war, to use the famous phrase, is stalemated.
It's really interesting, this concept of unexpected war in Ukraine, that, as you mentioned, and also you mentioned in one of your last publications in September, is continuing to be unexpected in a lot of facts. And my question is, for example, also in that publication in September, you mentioned that a lot of wars are being fought today. The expectance would be for them to be fought with AI or with mass destructive weapons. But my question is, why do you think that this is still seem not to be happening? What is the reason?
Yeah, I'll make a couple of points there. Well, the point I was making is that, you know, if you look at the new literature on warfare, you know, it's all about cyber, it's all about AI, it's all about what's up in space looking down at you, you know, disinformation, etc. You know, the new notion of new warfare, that's all. And all I was trying to say, that all of that plays a role in the Russia-Ukraine war. There's no doubt about it. But what has struck me and has struck many other observers who know much more about the military than I do, I'm no great expert on military, is how conventional the war looks. You know, you've got tanks, you've got bombings, you've got trenches, you've got barbed wire, you've got offensive and defensive. People are talking about how many bombs they've got, how many rockets they've got. Of course, there's a very modern aspect to all this, and I'm sure it's being played out and played. So all I was trying to say is we sometimes forget, you know, how conventional new wars can be, and also how extraordinarily brutal they can be. You know, when I look at the battlefields in Ukraine today, you know, what am I reminded of? I'm reminded of the First World War. That's what I'm reminded of. I'm not reminded of some clean, nice cyber war. What I'm reminded of is the typical brutal, you know, battle between blocks of men and some women, of course, you know, having their bodies smashed apart, and this terrible kind of attrition. And in some ways, what seems to me, and again, I speak as a non-expert, what's going on in Ukraine, both in the east, in Donbass, and in the south, is, you know, it's a war of attrition. And that, again, reminds me of the First World War. There's nothing speedy about this. There's nothing blitzkriegy. And there doesn't seem to mean much, which is actually very modern about that. War, in a sense, has come back to remind us of its sheer brutality. And if wars get locked and nobody, you know, achieves a major breakthrough quickly by whatever means, you're back to the old basics of warfare, of slugging it out with all the human consequences, both, you know, physical, psychological, and all the rest. I mean, take one issue for Ukraine. How much of their land, and it's basically an agricultural society, you know, that's most of its exports is food. How much of that is going to be ever, you know, usable again, given how many landmines are now left, how much chemical weapons is now on that land, you know, flooding whole sections of Ukraine. You know, this is old-fashioned warfare of the crudest variety. So that was the point I was trying to make, really. And I think we simply do need to be reminded about that. War in the end, as I think Napoleon put it, is brutal and nasty and involves a large number of usually men killing each other at the most rapid rates possible with all the appalling human consequences involved. It brings the human back into war, which I think we always need to be reminded of, because in the end, property can be rebuilt. People's lives, if they're dead, cannot be rebuilt.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a very powerful thing to end our discussion of kind of, you know, international events on. We wanted to have one last question because you are also an expert in the history of LSC. We know that there is a book that may be potentially coming out, but we are interested in a bit more large scale, or, you yes. know, more generally, what you think the role of institutions like the LSC is and has been in shaping policies and kind of influencing both academia and the larger policymaking world in general.
I think the LSE will be very happy when the book is completed, so I'm not going to make any quick promises about that.
Fair enough.
I have to keep avoiding people when I walk around the LSE. Keep going, when's that book coming out? It's a very academic response, isn't it? Right. All academics, I've always caught in that trap. But no, it's been a great privilege researching and writing and thinking about and doing blogs on and lectures on the history of the London School of Economics and Political Science, as I always point out. A great institution established in 1895, a unique in many, many ways. There aren't any institutions in this country, in the United Kingdom at least, which were established by four socialists. And the LSE was, by Beatrice and Sidney Webb, an extraordinary couple. George Bernard Shaw, the great Irish playwright, and the great political theorist and political scientist, Graham Wallace, who played a key role in the creation of a quite unique institution. And I think the uniqueness of the LSE is really fourfold. One, it was the first of its institutions in this country. There were others in France, but it was the first institutions in this country which wasn't like Oxford and Cambridge. Mm. I mean, there's no criticism meant of Oxford and Cambridge, but it was there to do very practical things. Whether it was studying banking, studying commerce, studying trade, studying the causes of poverty, thinking about how to solve the problems of poverty and inequality. And I think that was its prime mission. And I think that in that race, I think it has done an enormous amount over the years. We look at our alumni, we look at the people around the world, have a great affection for the LSE. Not all of them are on the left at all, not in the least, but many of them still retain a great affection for the LSE. Its impact, I think, has been particularly twofold, if I could be simple about this, because there's many more aspects to this we could talk about. And I'm going to try and make sure that goes into the book, of course. I think the first thing is, of course, that the welfare state in this country and the impact that had internationally, I won't say it was created and invented alone at the LSE. That would not be true. I mean, you know, the great Welsh Prime Minister Lloyd George, in the first Liberal budget of 1906-1907, laid the foundations of the welfare state. But much of the work done, which on unemployment, on social benefits, on poverty, on housing, on health, much of that came through what was done research at the LSE in the 20s and the 30s, and of course came out in the famous Beveridge Plan. And, you know, William Beveridge was the fourth director of the LSE, carried that plan through. And the Prime Minister who implemented many of those policies, Clement Attlee, was a teacher at the LSE before and after the First World War. His Chancellor of the Exchequer was an economics professor here. One of the great inspirations of that Labour government, which was a great reforming government. You know, many of them taught here at the LSE. So I think it's played a huge role in that dimension in terms of laying the foundations of a welfare state, at least back then. Where it is today, of course, that's another very big question. I think the second thing, I always talk about a man called Harold Laski, who was one of the great radicals of the LSE in the interwar period, died rather tragically in 1951. Harold Laski was an enormous figure at the school in terms of that period, a more radical period, I think, in the history of the school. And Harold played an enormous role in one particular area, in championing, supporting, endorsing, backing, fighting for, and getting organised in terms of Indian independence. And in terms of the history of the LSE, it was later called, you know, the great enemy of the British Empire by a number of people who supported the British Empire. This is one of the reasons I really like Harold Laski, because he was really so active in that particular role. Of course, I'm being very romantic about that particular part in history of the school, you know, that earlier phase. I mean, others would turn to me and say, if they're more conservative than I am, and say, but also didn't the LSE also have a man called, you know, Friedrich Hayek, you know, the great free market economist? Yeah. Didn't he, you know, propose a much more laissez-faire approach to economics? And didn't he inspire Mrs. Thatcher? And didn't he get a Nobel Prize? And didn't Mrs. Thatcher later on say, I always carry around copies of Hayek in my back pocket? So, you know, everybody can make a claim on the LSE. And it depends what your politics are and where you're coming from on that particular debate. But it just makes the general point, the impact of a little-known place called the LSE, which was established in one or two rooms on the other side of the Strand in 1895, with hardly any money, hardly any students, didn't even give out degrees, you know, has made the global impact that it has. And it says very much, not only about the great students who have come to here and the great people who have supported the school over the many years, but the great founders of the school. And I think, you know, if they look back now from wherever they're sitting in the sky or down there somewhere else or nowhere at all, you know, I think they'll be very surprised, but also nicely surprised by how their original invention, you know, has taken off and done so well around the world and got the global reputation that it does today.
Thank you very much. That was lovely to hear. It was lovely to have you on. And we'll see you all in the next episode.
And that's very nice of you to ask me all those questions, particularly the difficult ones at the end about when is this book coming.
Thank you very much, Professor.
See you in the next episode.